Introduction. The happiness versus right dilemma and the false economy of comfort. Would you rather be happy, or would you rather be right? Comedian Neil Brennan asked this question on his podcast and explores it in his Netflix special Blocks. The question lodged in my mind with unsettling persistence. For many, it resonates as a choice between ignorant bliss and burden. I regularly say, with a blend of dark humor and deep gratitude, that The Simpsons did more to raise me than anyone. In that brilliant comedy, Lisa Simpson once presented a hand-drawn graph illustrating a sharp inverse correlation. As intelligence goes up, happiness goes down. See, I made a graph. I make lots of graphs. Though Lisa's formulation is comically blunt, it pokes at something central to our experience. Maybe Lisa's graph and Brennan's question are both shorthand for a better question, one about time. Would you rather feel comfort now and face the consequences later? Or would you rather face the consequences now and ensure freedom later? In a culture saturated with advice on achieving happiness, optimizing comfort, and curating contentment, the pursuit of truth, especially uncomfortable truth, often feels like an impediment. While most of us would claim to prefer being right, whatever that truly means, our choices usually betray a gravitational pull toward present tense comfort. It sounds like work. Ultimately, it requires us to bind our present actions to a future reality we might prefer to ignore. The false economy of comfort. Our society runs on a hidden marketplace where truth, especially the inconvenient kind, is perpetually undervalued, while comfort and conformity are the affordable currencies. We have constructed an elaborate system, the false economy of comfort, that shields us from harsh realities and smooths over the jagged edges of existence. It undermines genuine understanding and collective resilience. This economy operates on a specific, hidden mechanism. It allows us to borrow credibility from the future to pay for ease today. But let's be precise about what this false economy is and what it isn't. Not all comfort is a form of denial. A healthy economy of comfort is not only legitimate but essential. This healthy version includes the comfort of genuine rest that restores our energy, the psychological safety of a trusted friendship that allows for vulnerability, or the stability of a routine that provides a firm foundation in a chaotic world. Healthy comfort is what recharges our capacity to be curious, resilient, and brave. Sometimes the healthiest thing is simple escape or solitude. Whatever form this restorative comfort takes, it serves as the necessary foundation for the emotional work this book demands. We cannot confront difficult truths when our own systems are running on empty. By contrast, the false economy extracts a steep price. Its currency is not restoration, but avoidance. The comfort purchased at the cost of truth. The ease that comes from looking away, from engaging in strategic ignorance, from outsourcing our conscience, or from accepting a reassuring lie over a disruptive fact. While a healthy economy builds our capacity to face reality, its counterpart erodes it. The false version offers the short-term sugar high of denial at the long-term cost of our collective resilience and individual inner coherence. The litmus test is simple. Does this comfort restore my capacity to engage with reality, or is it a mechanism to defer it? The former builds strength, while the latter builds a cage of denial within a vast, unexplored universe. This book is an exploration of that cage, its architecture, and the tools we might use to find our way out. Our systems feed into one another. Markets and economies are interdependent. The dot-com bust that began deflating in 2000 and the housing market collapse of 2008 were not merely financial events. They were lessons in how our draped-ape nature, our inherent cognitive fallibility and tendency toward social imitation can distort supposedly rational systems. This phenomenon is hardly new. Alan Greenspan famously warned of irrational exuberance during the 1990s tech bubble, and economist Robert Shiller, in his 2000 book of the same name, systematically explored the very draped apes tendencies this book discusses. These psychological and behavioral factors drive such speculative bubbles and widespread economic denial. Similarly, when social media algorithms exploit our psychological vulnerabilities to capture attention, they operate within a system in which engagement and clicks, not truth, drive value. This societal bargain of ease for ignorance is the undercurrent in all these examples, compelling us to prefer comforting illusions over disruptive realities. A trauma lens: wartime versus peacetime logic. This book explores a counterintuitive and potentially unsettling idea that significant trauma does not grant special wisdom or moral superiority, even the kind that shatters foundational assumptions of safety. Loss of trust in the world's coherence can inadvertently create a different relationship with time and truth, one that strips away the buffer between cause and consequence and makes comfortable fictions unaffordable. Before we proceed, a distinction is useful. You, the reader, may be operating in what I'll call peacetime, where the primary goals are stability, optimization, and the minimization of friction. This book is written from a different place. It is written from wartime. For those who have navigated severe adversity, choosing comforting fictions over reality can become a luxury they can no longer afford. Trauma collapses time. When the knife is already out, you cannot say, "I will deal with this later." The future has already arrived, and it is threatening. When the systems meant to protect you fail spectacularly, and when the narratives you were told to believe are crumbling, survival itself demands new tools. It necessitates a heightened awareness of hypocrisy and of the subtle workings of denial that others might miss. It is like being shipwrecked in uncharted waters. Survival requires a new form of navigation. This collapse of time creates a divergence in logic. To a peacetime reader, the urgency in these pages may feel like aggression. It may feel like I am handing you a survival manual at a barbecue. But for those of us who have been shipwrecked, this trauma lens, while initially a painful and uncalibrated burden, offers something crucial: the ability to perceive patterns that those comfortably insulated within the prevailing denial might miss. The result is a collection of orphaned truths, realities too disruptive for the dominant narrative, too heavy for conversation. I carried my own for years. Truths like the unacknowledged violence of a childhood knife fight and the systemic silence that later swallowed my uncle's murder. The pressure to mask one's reality for the comfort of others is a heavy and isolating burden. It is the quiet engine of a Cassandra complex, the torment of seeing the future consequences of present actions while being disbelieved, dismissed, or unwelcomed. Consider the historical parallels journalist Evan Osnos draws between our current era and past moments of civilizational crisis. When he quotes the late Yale scholar Ramsay MacMullen's distillation of Rome's 500-year decline into three bare words: fewer had more. Or when he describes our current wealth concentration as reminiscent of the Gilded Age's cartoonish extravagance, these are not just academic observations. For someone whose childhood was defined by precarity and systemic abandonment, whose formative experiences involved watching institutions prioritize appearance over intervention, these patterns feel hauntingly familiar. The architecture of denial is the same whether it allows a family to ignore dysfunction or a civilization to decay. It operates at every scale, built on willful blindness, institutional inertia, and the prioritization of comfort over truth. It's the same architecture, just with more zeros attached to the consequences. This recognition that personal trauma can illuminate broader social pathologies isn't unique to my experience, but the specific vantage point it creates might be. The insider-outsider perspective, emerging from navigating significant adversity while also functioning within mainstream professional environments, provides a dual consciousness. Understanding both the lived reality of systemic failure and the comfortable fictions that allow those failures to persist. It's a lens calibrated by necessity to detect the gap between proclaimed values and actual behavior, between surface narratives and underlying dynamics. This lens was no sudden gift of clarity. At first, it offered only a bewildering blur of chaos, a fractured view that scattered as much as it revealed. The journey described in these pages is one of slow, painstaking calibration. The work of grinding that broken shard into a functional lens, of learning how to adjust its focus. It recounts the shift from bearing trauma as a crushing weight that obscured vision to shaping it into an instrument of perception. A finely ground and polished lens, after all, does more than help us see. It can also be used for spotlighting or to project a clear image. In this way, perception becomes illumination. What once revealed only the treacherous currents and hidden reefs of experience, when sharpened, began to cast its light outward as a lighthouse beam. A lighthouse not only illuminates the dangers that have long been hidden, it creates a safer passage for other vessels. This is the journey of the navigator, from shipwreck survivor clinging to debris, to the builder of a beacon for others. The historical context Osnos provides frames our current moment as potentially pivotal. His observation that people would say, "We can't go on like this," during the Gilded Age, which ultimately gave way to the Progressive Era and the New Deal, suggests that societies can reach a breaking point where the false economy of comfort becomes unsustainable. However, recognizing these potential breaking points and alternative paths requires clear-eyed assessments, the kind trauma often forces, but comfort typically obscures. This book, then, is not just a diagnosis, it is an invoice. It is the receipt for the comfort we have purchased by deferring the truth. What this book is, and what it isn't. Before you open that invoice, you should know how it was assembled. This book is not a memoir, though it draws on personal experience. It is not an academic work, though it engages seriously with thinkers across multiple disciplines. It is not a textbook, though it offers frameworks and formulas. If you try to read it as any one of these, it will frustrate you. It is something else. I am not the originator of most of the ideas in these pages. Haidt, Bonhoeffer, Cipolla, Kahneman, Keats, Chomsky, Frankl, Schiller, Gladwell, Havel, these thinkers and many others did the primary work. What I have done is arrange them. I have taken observations from psychology, economics, philosophy, neuroscience, history, and lived experience, and laid them side by side to see if the patterns align. They do, more than I expected when I started, and in ways that are difficult to dismiss as coincidence. The false economy of comfort, the draped apes framework, the credibility formula, the concept of temporal binding, these are my interpretive contributions, the connective tissue, not the bones. The argument of this book is therefore not deductive. I am not proving a theorem. The power is in the convergence, the fact that thinkers from radically different disciplines, examining different problems across different centuries, keep describing the same underlying architecture of avoidance. When a psychologist, an economist, a philosopher, and a trauma survivor independently point at the same wall, that is evidence, strong evidence, that the wall is real. It is not proof. The wall might be a shadow cast by separate structures that merely look connected from where I'm standing. I don't think it is, but you get the honesty of me saying so. In plainer terms, the boat floats. I've checked it for holes, and I've sailed it through rough water. But I built it from salvage, other people's lumber joined by my own joinery. And I'm telling you that up front rather than pretending I felled the trees myself. You may find yourself reacting in one of two ways as you read. The first, he thinks he's proved all this. That the book overclaims. That it presents a grand unified theory with an arrogance that outstrips its evidence. The second, these are just opinions dressed up with citations. That it underclaims. That it's polemic disguised as analysis. I've thought about both reactions, and I understand why they arise. The density of the cross-referencing feels like a closed system, which triggers the first. The personal voice and the anger feel like editorializing, which triggers the second. What I'm actually offering is a framework, not a verdict. If the pattern holds across enough domains and enough thinkers, that is reason to take it seriously. If it doesn't hold in places, that's reason to ask why it breaks there, not to abandon the whole frame. This is not a theory to be accepted or rejected wholesale. It is a toolkit to be tested. I am asking you to try it, not to believe in it. The credibility crisis and our draped ape nature. The great physicist Richard Feynman once said, "I would rather have questions that can't be answered than answers that can't be questioned." That sentiment feels more urgent than ever. We live in an era of shouted certainties and algorithmically amplified opinions, where the pressure to take a side usually eclipses the courage to explore the messy, uncomfortable gray areas. Perhaps true wisdom lies less in finding all the answers than in learning to ask the right questions. As a guiding principle, I offer a rule I learned while navigating environments thick with denial. Never trust an absolutist. Anyone selling perfect certainty or demanding you ignore complexity warrants deep skepticism. Absolutism is denial's native tongue. It is an attempt to freeze time. To declare that no future information will ever require us to change our minds. The past few presidential cycles have turned these dynamics into vivid images, from the angry glow of tiki torches on a college campus to the performative lip service of a corporate land acknowledgement, spoken with all the warmth of a quarterly earnings report. Political and social upheavals seem to rip the lid off, exposing patterns of denial that have been simmering for decades. It wasn't new, but it has been loud. It forces a confrontation. It also highlights an ancient warning. The Greeks cautioned that incompetent certainty inflicts far more damage than outright malice. This is a pattern tragically repeated throughout history, from the Peloponnesian War to the present day. The stakes of human judgment, of our collective ability to perceive and respond to reality, only escalate as our technological power grows. This brings us to a concept that requires careful handling. Not because the idea is fragile, but because the language around it is loaded with shame. When we speak of societal missteps or collective irrationality, the word stupid comes to mind. But let's approach this idea without judgment. Let's reframe it through a powerful, modern parallel. The staggering rise in obesity is not a mass failure of willpower. It is a predictable outcome of a food environment where, for many, the only visible or affordable options are nutrient-poor and engineered for overconsumption. Our environments demand screen time, but not much physical work. If we feel overwhelmed, distracted, or even stupid, it's not due to a sudden collapse in individual intelligence. We are suffering from cognitive malnourishment, force-fed a diet from the high-fructose feed, a constant stream of sensationalist clickbait, polarizing memes, and algorithmically amplified outrage. We're gorging on the intellectual equivalent of gas station nachos, cheap, instantly gratifying, and devoid of nutrition, while wondering why we feel so sluggish and confused. In a world offering an all-you-can-eat buffet of outrage and distraction, the path to clarity may look like a sad, unappealing kale salad. This high-fructose feed is so effective precisely because it exploits our inherent cognitive architecture, our draped ape vulnerabilities to novelty, tribalism, and emotionally resonant, but intellectually empty content. It is the polluted current that makes the crew mutinous and keeps the ship sailing in circles. From this perspective, stupidity is not an insult. It is a shared, systemic condition, a predictable symptom of a toxic information diet designed for our species. It's not a personal failing to feel this way. It's a human one, as universal as having two arms and a head. Later chapters explore how this foundational idea of universal cognitive fallibility relates to other perspectives on stupidity. Dietrich Bonhoeffer's view of it as a moral failing, Jonathan Haidt's concept of systemic stupidity, Carlo Cipolla's framework of irrational destructive impact, and how phenomena like anti-intellectualism might serve as a societal defense mechanism against the discomfort of confronting these inherent limitations. The point, then, is to approach this idea not as an accusation, but as a starting point for understanding why the false economy of comfort is so pervasive and why pursuing truth can feel arduous. Good information is best found from credible sources. We often assume credibility comes from intelligence, credentials, or articulation. But in a world awash in AI-generated text and polished spin, intelligence is cheap. What is scarce is obligation. Consider credibility through this framework. Credibility equals intelligence multiplied by obligation divided by insulation. True credibility requires both intelligence, the ability to process reality, and obligation, the binding of oneself to consequences. If one is missing, credibility collapses regardless of how much you have of the other. Even with both these ingredients, insulation devalues the final result. Intelligence doesn't mean IQ or academic credentials. It means the capacity to perceive and respond to what's actually happening. A mother who senses her child is struggling before words are spoken has this intelligence. A floor nurse who notices the subtle change in a patient's breathing has it. A tradesman who can tell by sound that a machine is about to fail has it. Intelligence is reality contact, the ability to take in the world as it is, not as we wish it to be. Obligation is the binding of oneself to consequences. It means you will experience the results of your judgments, decisions, and theories. When you're wrong, you pay a price. When you're right, you benefit. Your skin is in the game, not metaphorically, but structurally. The mother bears the consequences of misreading her child. The tradesman bears the consequences of misjudging the machine. Obligation is what makes intelligence accountable rather than merely performative. Insulation is protection from the results. Wealth can insulate. You advocate policies whose costs fall on others. Power can insulate. You make decisions, but subordinates live with them. Anonymity can insulate. You opine without your name attached to the outcome. Organizational position can insulate. The individual can stay after the implementation fails. Distance, temporal, geographic, social, can insulate. Insulation breaks the feedback loop between judgment and consequence. It's the buffer that allows you to be wrong without suffering the wrongness. When insulation is high, you can possess enormous intelligence and even claim obligation. I care deeply about this, while never actually bearing the weight of being wrong. When insulation becomes infinite, credibility collapses to zero, no matter how smart or articulate you sound. Consider Jeff Bezos, who bought the Washington Post, slogan, "Democracy dies in darkness," professing to safeguard the institution. Now he's laying off a third of the workforce. One of the richest people on the planet just turned off the lights in a third of the building. His intelligence is undeniable. His stated obligation to journalism was loud. But his insulation from the consequences, from ever needing the paycheck, the healthcare, the institutional continuity he's dismantling, is effectively infinite. The formula works as advertised. Infinite insulation, zero credibility. The obligation was a lie. Credibility requires intelligence and obligation without insulation. This is the crisis of our age. We are ruled by entities, algorithms, institutions, elites that possess massive intelligence but bear zero obligation, insulated entirely from the futures they are creating. If we feel stupid, it is often because we are trying to make sense of a world run by the insulated. A moment of witness, the spark for this book. There are rare moments, unexpected and transformative, when one encounters an individual who does more than listen. I had such an experience that proved pivotal in bringing this book to fruition. A good friend, Nico, invited me camping with his longtime friend group, a tribe I was eager to meet. Around a late-night fire, I found myself in conversation with Ben, someone whose genuine curiosity and intellectual depth created a space I hadn't quite experienced before. It wasn't a therapeutic setting, nor was it the familiar dynamic of a long-standing friendship, where one might cautiously edit for fear of overwhelming the other person. It was an encounter marked by genuine curiosity, remarkable intellectual depth, and an unvarnished engagement with difficult ideas. In a context unbound by professional obligation or the careful calculus of friendship, for what felt like the first time, someone actually asked and cared. Not just about the surface, but about the intricate, painful connections I was trying to articulate regarding this collapse of obligation. In that exchange, a powerful sense of clarity and validation emerged. It wasn't that Ben agreed with everything. It was that he actually understood. He met the complexity with his own and, in doing so, provided a space where my orphaned truths felt not just acknowledged, but heard and seen as valuable insights rather than mere damage. It was the startling realization that heavy truths didn't have to destroy connection, that an outlier's perspective could find resonance, and that the very experiences that had felt like impediments to being understood were, in fact, the bedrock of essential insights. This interaction offered more than comfort. It relit the fire of intellectual and moral urgency. It affirmed that these explorations into denial, trauma, and coherence were not simply personal obsessions, but vital inquiries worth pursuing and perhaps sharing. It was a pivotal moment in calibrating my own lens, a demonstration that insights born of trauma could indeed find resonance and offer value, moving them from orphaned burdens toward potential beacons. The book itself might have remained another unarticulated frustration, another set of observations confined to the internal world of an insider-outsider, had it not been for that catalytic moment of genuine understanding. The path this book takes. Fueled by that spark of clarity, this book delves into these dynamics. It explores the paradox that those most bruised by the system are also the ones who see its flaws with the most painful acuity. They become unwilling experts in the orphaned truths that society prefers to abandon. Malcolm Gladwell, in his podcast series, I Hate the Ivy League, touches on related themes. He discusses how fragile talent can be in disadvantaged contexts and how abysmally low society's capitalization rate, its ability to help people reach their potential, often is for those navigating such realities. For many, their clarity about the system's failings isn't an abstract exercise. It is embedded into their understanding through direct, painful experience. This raw clarity reveals that society's definitions of comfort and truth are not fixed, but are constantly renegotiated. Consider the stoic outward appearance that past generations prized. This societal comfort came at the cost of forcing all psychological distress into the private, heavily stigmatized shadows. The public discourse and support for mental health we now take for granted are recent inventions, illustrating how profoundly the bargains we strike can shift. This pattern of unacknowledged costs is not new, and its modern scale is alarming. The historical parallels drawn by journalist Evan Osnos serve as a stark warning. He describes the growth of radical inequality as a crisis so large and encompassing that it's almost like climate change, a reality that becomes both omnipresent and nearly invisible, perceptible only when one steps outside the insulating reassurance of the dominant narrative. This book examines the workings of denial, the class dynamics of truth, and the anxieties that drive us from reality. We will consider how raw truths can reshape this lens of perception and how moments of genuine witness can give it new purpose. The book charts an uncomfortable voyage. Still, it offers something the marketplace of denial cannot: the possibility of deeper understanding, more authentic connection, and the resilience that comes from binding our present actions to their future consequences. What you will find here is an invitation to examine the comforting narratives of our culture, to question the value of unexamined ease, and to consider whether facing truth in all its disorienting complexity may be the most reliable foundation for wisdom, integrity, and meaningful action in turbulent times. If you're willing to take this journey, it offers a framework for asking better questions, navigational tools for developing inner coherence, and the recognition that the experiences that make life difficult can also sharpen your perception, transforming a shard of wreckage into a reliable lens. The trauma-informed insider-outsider lens isn't offered as the only way to see, but as one way that might illuminate patterns others miss, patterns that, once recognized, cannot be unseen. These new perspectives offer the possibility of more honest engagement with the world as it is, rather than as we wish it to be. It is an offer to stop borrowing from the future and start building a better one.